Sex tugs at the brains of even the most sophisticated creatures. Sex, at its core, is a simple need that requires biological fulfillment. It's a powerful need, in short. But sexual satisfaction can come from a number of different places. And unlike other core needs of the human condition, the need for sex has different methods of fulfillment for different people. Some simply require the physical company of their husband or wife, and they make up the majority of sexual relationships. Others, though, have ways of satisfying this need that may prove somewhat unconventional. There are those who have fascination with toys, those who use pornography to meet their needs. There are even those who break the boundaries of their relationship to satisfy their unquenched urges. In many cases, these needs and the ways people choose to meet themselves are harmless after all. What happens between consenting adults most happily stays between consenting adults. However, there are outliers to this rule. There are times when, in the heat of sexual conduct, a person or group of people takes the game too far. There are times, too, when the thoughts that flood a person's mind amidst passionate acts become violent. At these times, it's safe to say that these thoughts are best discussed professionally. That is, it's advisable to bring these issues to someone equipped to aid the human mind against the addictions and negative behaviors that can come from certain sexual encounters. These people don't often get the help they need, though, and the aftermath of a lover spat is regularly quite bloody. There are human needs, and we are afforded the right to fantasize. But when someone acts on others who don't succumb to their fantasies, they're committing a crime, violating others' rights, destroying the sense of safety that we are meant to experience when having sex. And if we can't enjoy sex in our own ways with a sense of safety and welfare, then the chances of living a healthy life reach a deep deficit. Depending on who impedes one's safety, even chances of survival can be slim. As I said, lovers sometimes leave quite a mess when crossed.
You are listening to Devil We Know, a true crime podcast, which may contain adult themes, explicit language, and graphic depictions of violence. Portions of the show may be traumatic for those under 18. Listener discretion is advised.
Everywhere we look, everywhere we go, every city, every town, every neighborhood, every street, there is a devil we know. This is Devil We Know, and I am your host, Aaron. Jerry Michael Williams, known by his friends and family as Mike, was loved by many. His parents cared for him greatly, which is why they worked hard to give him a private school education. They believed that paying for a Christian school education would help prepare Mike for the future life he was going to live. In a way, it did. At school, Mike found his best friend, Brian Winchester. Brian and Mike both met their future wives. Kathy would become Kathy Winchester, and Mike would eventually marry Denise Merrill. These two couples spent a majority of their time together, from high school and on. It wasn't long before the couples grew incredibly close. And the closeness would only increase as they reached adulthood. Mike became a commercial property appraiser, while Brian took a job as an insurance broker. The two married their high school sweethearts in the mid-90s, and they remained inseparable during that time, always going places together as a group. Soon, though, the foursome they formed was going to take on a different meaning. There was a highly sexual vibe pushed regularly between the couples. Even though they had a foundation of Christian values from their childhood and schooling, this vibe and its implications were mainly pursued by Brian, whose interest in Denise as a secondary partner caused him to broach the idea of a group sex activity. Mike, however, was against this, and he tended to silence while the discussions of such activity between the other three continued at length. Little did Mike know, that's not all these three were sharing between them. Mike's devotion to his wife was well acknowledged by all those who knew him. They shared a daughter, and he worked hard to bring home over $200,000 a year for their small family. In being so financially stable, Mike even discussed with Denise the idea of having a second child. To him, this was the ideal next step for them to grow as a family. And for that reason, Denise implored Mike to consider increasing his life insurance policy along with it. This was not the first time that she had suggested this. Before Mike married Denise, his policy was worth $250,000. And his mother was named the beneficiary. Once he married, however, He changed this beneficiary to his new wife, who eventually requested he doubled it. The impending discussions of an increase in their family led Denise to bring up the increase of Mike's policy once again, this time from a $500,000 policy to one worth $1 million. Mike again saw the merit in this request, and he made the change. The person to sell him this policy was none other than his best friend, Brian Winchester. Brian, though, had not only taken Mike's money to initiate the change for him, he had also been taking liberty with Mike's wife. The lewd discussions between Brian, Kathy, and Denise had definitely not gone over well with Mike, but these three had done more than just discuss group sex. They had acted accordingly. Brian had regularly engaged in sexual activity with both Denise and Kathy together, and they often took videos and photos of the acts. It may have been the end of a beautiful friendship, since Mike was completely in the dark about the heinous affair that was occurring between his best friend and their two wives. Mike may have never found out, though, because soon after he purchased that new policy, he went missing, and soon after was declared deceased. It was unclear in the year 2000 what would have caused Mike's sudden disappearance. He had a hunting trip planned, and afterward was meant to head straight home to his wife for their 6-year anniversary trip. It was supposed to be quite the busy day for Mike. He had headed out to begin his duck hunt early in the morning, planning to be back only after a few hours. His devotion to Denise was enough to bring him straight home once it was time. After all, this was meant to be a relaxing getaway for the two of them. Those few hours passed, and Mike's boat hadn't returned to land, and he had yet to reach his Ford Bronco, waiting dutifully in the swamps of Florida for his return. Mike's delay, after a few more hours, began to worry Denise, and she decided to call Brian Winchester about the fact that Mike had not returned home. Brian, the dutiful best friend, began a search party with his father, Marcus, who loved Mike as a son, and shared the worry that the other two seemed to wear on their sleeves. Although Mike had left in the morning, the search party went on for hours to find nothing in the light of day. Darkness came, and the signs of Mike's return to shore appeared to the last two searchers of the day, Brian and Marcus. Mike's Bronco and his boat were both found. With a sigh of relief, the two realized that this job was in need of professional help. With the help of the Jackson County Law Enforcement Agency, an official search was organized to pursue Mike after the discovery of his truck and boat. In the heat of the search, Brian found a hat in the bog that resembled Mike's usual hunting hat, after which the presumption of Mike's death by drowning became the official story. This particular area was lousy with drowning hazards, and the prospect of losing control and hitting a gnarled tree or a rock in the bog water was all too likely to ignore. It seemed that the authorities had their answer, with or without a body. They knew, though, that they had to simply wait. If Mike did indeed drown, then he, like all the other drowning victims from this area, would simply float back up in a few days to be found easily by law enforcement. And wait they did. It proved unsettling for the parties involved, though, because Mike simply did not show up. Although Denise was told that 100% of the corpses in the swamp eventually rose to be found, the team had no such luck. After days of no body, it was assumed that Mike instead had been eaten by a predator in the water, such as an alligator. With this decision came the order to look for and recover human body parts in order to verify Mike's death in this fashion. This again was to no avail. After the search was called off, a memorial service was held to honor Mike. Only after this did a fisherman discover a pair of waders that contained Mike's fishing license. Alongside a couple of other items, the discovery of these waders, which seemed to be in good condition, begged a multitude of questions. First, why were they intact? It was common knowledge to those who recovered bodies from the water before that these waders should have been deteriorating slowly in the water, and contrary to the new theory, there was no bite marks to be found. It was almost as if they were just simply placed in the water to be found by another party. Whatever the case, it was clear that the nature of Mike's watery death or disappearance was fishy. In the interest of all things fishy, it's important to note one other detail about the time period in which Mike disappeared. He had recently purchased the new $1 million insurance policy at his wife's behest. That, in itself, was not necessarily noteworthy. However, the period of time covered by the new policy overlapped briefly with the old policy's coverage. In fact, it was only during this overlapping period that Mike disappeared, and shortly before the old policy ended. Denise spoke up in response to the found waders and the discovery of Mike's fishing license. She requested that Mike be declared dead. With Mike now dead, the activation of both policies would be in effect, and Denise, the beneficiary, would be prepared to receive both of them. While in effect, she pushed for the incurrence of both policies by declaring him dead, only a matter of days after his disappearance. Strangely, this was awarded to Denise, even though most Florida cases of disappearance only result in declaration of death after 5 years missing. Regardless, Denise took help from Brian and Marcus Winchester, who helped her with the paperwork and in finding a lawyer to help her quickly begin her life without Mike. The tryst between Denise and the Winchester couple was one other element that didn't seem to sit right in the wake of Mike's disappearance. Although the dalliance was a secret, it's known that Kathy eventually grew jealous in her interactions between the three of them. Perhaps, actually, it was interactions that excluded her that bothered her the most. She would find evidence of purchases that were clearly not made for her, and she suspected an affair. With the feeling of being a third wheel while going out with Denise and Brian, she began to even suspect that Denise was the homewrecker in question. Around the same time that Mike was declared dead, Kathy and Brian separated, leaving room for the secret romance between Denise and Brian to culminate. Kathy and Denise remained friends, but it wasn't long before Denise and Brian took this relationship to the next level. She married him shortly afterward, and the suspicious activity between them tipped off another person, who was much, much closer to the case of Mike Williams. Mike's mother, Cheryl. Cheryl Williams was beside herself with a broken heart and a mind full of questions when her son was declared missing in December of 2000. She had suspicions that the circumstance of Mike's supposed death were less than circumstantial. She spent time researching the case along with writing letters to the state governor for years to appeal for an investigation. Only after a few years of pursuit was she able to help the Florida Department of Law Enforcement in opening an actual investigation into Mike's death. While Denise had readily accepted the accidental drowning as the likely story of Mike's demise, Cheryl dug deeper. Denise noticed this and began threatening Cheryl. She withheld Cheryl's visiting rights to see her own granddaughter, all in response to her simple but impressive approach to getting the truth about Mike's disappearance. While Cheryl loved her little grandchild, she could not bear to abandon her son, to whom no justice had been given yet. She resolved to take the investigation even more seriously now, noting the strangeness in Denise and Brian's insistence against doing so. Cheryl began to take notes, eventually taking the time to poke holes in the two standing theories of Mike's disappearance. For one, the accidental drowning story seemed highly unlikely, since such an event would result in the boat being abandoned while running. While this scenario ends in a boat that would be empty of gas, the tank of the boat found after Mike's disappearance was full of gas. That discrepancy was one of several that clinched this particular theory as a fruitless one. In addition, the notion that an alligator ate him, while appealing to the lazy and unimaginative, was also impossible. Cheryl discovered in her discussions with a wildlife expert that alligators experience a particular hibernation pattern in low temperatures, and since the waters were about 19 degrees at that time of year when Mike disappeared, there was no chance of an alligator being able to feed. These debunked theories, alongside facts like the early declaration of Mike's death by his widow, led Cheryl to believe there really was foul play. Not every life was impeded by Mike's death. Denise Williams, who had taken Brian's name, was flourishing under the new routine. Brian and Denise Winchester, try as they did to shut Cheryl up, eventually became persons of interest in the case of Mike's disappearance. Although not much came up in the time they were followed, the couple's divorce filing in 2015 caught the attention of the authorities, and it wasn't too long before they were given a reason to swoop in for information. Brian, who became estranged from his wife and stepkid, was hiding inside of Denise's car when she pulled out of her driveway to leave home. Brian, manic and nervous, asked Denise to find a remote place where they could talk. He assured her, gun in hand, that talking is all he wanted to do. However, Denise was unsure how much of this she could believe. Keeping in mind the surveillance cameras that could potentially save her from death, Denise drove into a CVS parking lot to speak with her husband, who was now pointing the gun at her. He intended to check on her and ensure that she meant to continue hiding the awful nature of their previous acts. He also meant to take his own life, if that's what was necessary. He had a lot to worry about, apparently, but this encounter gave him even more in terms of trouble. Not only was he about to lose his mother to terminal cancer, but his wife was leaving him. Brian's troubles were not over yet. Denise talked him down, saying that she still loved him. She said that he couldn't kill himself, that there was too many people who cared about him. He then worried about the gunpoint encounter, and Denise assured him that there was nothing to worry about. He just had to let her go, and she wouldn't say a word. He left the vehicle through the back, and he took several murder weapons and cleanup equipment with him, leaving Denise shaken and speechless. Soon enough, though, she found herself calling her brother-in-law, an officer of the Leon County Police, for advice. Denise explained to her brother-in-law that she was in a bit of a situation with Brian, and she wanted to know how she could get a restraining order against him. Much to her chagrin, though, he explained that she ought to report the incident that just occurred. It was the best way to make sure he couldn't bother her again. She was not keen on the idea, but resolved that she could report what she needed to get an order in place. She would not need to press charges, just to talk about the problems she was having with him. Denise resisted a bit, stating she didn't want to endanger Brian. Her brother-in-law rebutted by saying that he had already done that to her. The eventual trip to the police station was the culmination of his convincing Denise that it simply had to be done. Denise came into the station and immediately discovered there was much more conversation abuzz about her and her estranged husband. In fact, their interest was deep, and they had been looking for a reason to speak to one of them about something that had happened over a decade ago. They wanted to know about Mike. In an interview, the line of questioning was directed many a time to Denise's knowledge of Mike's whereabouts. Denise, for her part, had shown very little response to this, having stated to the police that she was only there to get a restraining order against Brian. Although she protested against this particular line of questioning, the police continued to barrage her, until finally, after an hour and a half, her brother-in-law came into the room. He pled with her to speak on Mike's disappearance, saying that he knew Brian was guilty and that she most likely knew something was up after marrying him. Turn him in, he advised, and she would be free of him. Out of fear of Brian or for what would happen to her, Denise did not condemn her estranged husband. Her brother-in-law insisted, but after enough refusal, he left the job to another law enforcement officer, someone from the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, or the FDLE. Mike Devaney, a special agent of the FDLE, sat down with Denise to discuss the problem at hand. Not Brian's contemporaneous defection, but the real issue, the missing persons case that was over a decade old. According to Devaney and his peers, the case did not truly come to a close, and now that a person of interest was sitting in a police station, they felt it was time to get answers. In the interview, it becomes clear that Devaney had made a career out of his person of interest, Brian Winchester and Denise Williams Winchester. It was a long job in the making, but Devaney knew things about Denise that no one in her life kept track of, including who her neighbors were and the renovations she had made to the house. It was clear that she was not sitting in front of some clueless investigator, but a professional with a good nose for the fishy details that had eluded discovery for so long. While in the room, Devaney grills Denise for information on Mike and his disappearance, looking for any information that could help bring his killers to justice. For her part, Denise stayed resolute, stating that she believed Mike drowned. The following is a clip from the interview, during which Devaney reveals his relationship to Denise and proceeds to get a decent amount of information from her.
We have never met. My name is Mike Devaney. How are you doing? Do you know that name at all?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'm with the Florida Department of Law Enforcement. Okay. I've literally known you and I've known your family for many, 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 many years. Okay. The reason I say that is, you know, I've been looking into Mike's disappearance. Okay. Literally dissected as much as I could about you, you know, members of your family, Brian, Mike, and, you know, his family, and the family when you and Mike were together, okay? Worked with a lot of people, you know, trying to figure out the whole scenario of his disappearance, and had to go back and literally reinvestigate a lot of things that was investigated before, okay? And again, I had to go back to y'all's marriage, and what were you doing during those times? What were you doing job-wise? And Mike, you know, and Mike's employer, the whole works. Okay, what you all owed, what you didn't owe. And this has been an ongoing process for a long time. You need to understand that. Okay, you know, I used to know your gate code by heart and going to your neighborhood. I know your house very well. You know, I know when you took the carpet out, the whole works. You know, there's a whole lot I don't know. Okay, please understand that.
Talking about the hardwood floors upstairs.
You name it, I know about it.
Okay.
Okay. I want to talk to you about a couple of things. Maybe you can fill in a couple of gaps for me. Can you do that for me?
I can try.
Okay. Obviously, the reason I'm here, I knew about what happened today. Okay. And like the other officers said, it's going to have to sink in that today was going to be your last day. Please let that sink in. I mean, he didn't have sheets to sleep on, you know, tonight or the night before or the night after. He had plastic and he had some other object. What was that other object he had? Could you tell? Can you describe it?
It was like maybe wide. It wasn't a hammer, but it was kind of that size and maybe wider. I have no idea what it was.
A small shovel?
No, it wasn't a shovel. I mean, it was like it definitely wasn't a shovel. But it was about the size, the length of like a hammer. But it seemed to be fatter the way that he grabbed it, but I have no idea.
Well, now we're going towards CVS. It's what I can understand. He wanted to turn around and go the other way.
He kept saying going the roundabout, and I think he was wanting me to go back, but
towards
I wasn't really listening. I wasn't really listening. I was just trying to get to CVS.
Where do you think Mike's buried at?
Oh, I have no idea.
Any speculation on that?
On where he's buried?
Buried.
I mean, I believe...
You don't really believe he died on the lake?
I do.
Why?
I just always have. That's what I believe. And I have... From when he was saying roundabout, I have... I don't know. I've talked with the last two people, and I can't remember if he wanted me to turn left or right.
No. That's not what I'm talking about. Why do you think Mike perished in the lake? He didn't die like Seminole, okay?
That's what I've always believed. That's what I believe.
And why?
I've never been proven anything different.
Well, has there been any proof he died? If he would have perished in that lake, he would have been found. Okay? There's never been a person that has fallen or whatever that they've never found except for Mike. I mean, that's literally, it's a possibility that he died in that lake.
I guess that's just what I believe.
Really? Well, I mean, you knew all the information about, you know, what was recovered out there and all that, right?
My dad would keep me updated,
yeah. Yeah, this big monster search and none of that, and then later it just appears. I mean, that kind of led investigators going in different directions than what they initially thought. Okay. I mean, I was even curious. I mean, I recovered the car that I used to have during that time. I got it from a junkyard in Alabama, where I would carry it toward the park. The little boat that Mike had, a little Guinea boat, I found it over in Monticello, brought it back. I just wanted to get a good look at it. You know, there's a whole lot of stuff. You don't have a clue what we've looked at. And we've certainly come to the conclusion that Mike did not, again, perish or die on Lake Seminole. Okay? Please understand that. You know, we've kind of tracked what's been going on in y'all's lives, again, before Mike disappeared all the way till now. Okay, we knew about the divorce stuff. You know, we knew about people living in different places and all works. Talked to Kathy, she probably didn't tell you that. Probably she may have.
Yeah.
Okay, all right. And you seem to say you don't have a clue what ever happened to Mike. Were you and Mike, Kathy, and Brian, y'all were pretty close before Mike disappeared, right?
Yeah.
How close were y'all?
Well, I mean, I would say we talked pretty much every day. We were very close.
Yeah.
I'm still very close with Trump.
Yeah, I know that. I mean, again, we researched, you know, trips y'all used to make to Orlando and some other stuff. Apparently, you were really close. Okay. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I don't. Me and Kathy still, she's texting me right now, so we're still very close.
Okay. If I say we're totally aware of all the videos, you probably know what I'm talking about.
If you say what?
The videos.
I would have to see them.
Probably that's not going to happen. But you, okay. You're clueless when I say videos.
I don't. Yeah.
You, Kathy and Brian?
I would have to see them.
Yeah. You have no idea what I'm talking about. You don't say you've never seen them.
No, I'm just starting to feel very uncomfortable.
Okay.
But
I've been uncomfortable for a long time because we needed some things on this case.
Right.
And we were hoping one day that either Brian or you maybe could fill in some of the gaps there, fill in a piece of the puzzle.
Right. But I guess right now I need to focus on this and what happened this morning, and I want to get this restraining order done by 5:00, and I want me and my daughter to be safe. And that's where I'm focused.
There's no doubt that Brian's going to be located and put in jail. So I would imagine he's not going to immediately be bonded out under the circumstances and the crimes that he's committed. Okay.
I don't know. But I just want to get this restraining order done so that I can have a little peace for tonight with my daughter. That's what I'm focused on.
Well, if he's arrested, you know, in the next few hours, which I'm sure is going to happen. You know, Leon County is very good about finding people. Okay. That's going to happen. When Brian is arrested, which will happen, he is going to probably provide another side of whatever happened today. You're aware of that?
From this morning?
Yeah.
I have no idea what's going to happen.
Well, that's what people usually do. They give their side of something. He starts talking about the past, way in the past.
What if he starts talking about
the disappearance of Mike?
I hope he admits this morning. I hope he admits what he did. If they ask him about Mike, I have no idea. I mean, we'll see.
Yeah. Well, has Kathy ever talked about Mike's disappearance? Or not Mike's, but Brian's disappearance? Did they Mike disappear?
I don't remember.
Yeah.
I can text her right now.
No,
I don't remember.
Okay. Brian just disappeared.
Has he ever talked about that? I'd have to talk with her. But again, I really want to focus on this. And if you, I mean,
well, this is
I understand that this is what you want to talk about.
Well, this thing tonight, you know, is kind of a done deal. You know, we know what happened. It's going to be verified in the video and all that. Whether Brian admits to what he did to you today, he did it. And once they arrest him, I'm sure they're going to find some of the things that you talked about. That's kind of a done deal. Okay. But obviously, things have been building for a long, long time.
Well, we've been separated for a long time.
Yeah.
But for me, again, I want to file this restraining order before 3:30, before 5. So I don't know if it's 3:30 right now. I just want to make sure that I have time to do that. That's my priority right now.
Well, I don't know what time it is.
Denise wasn't given an inch. The questions were designed to help make her slip. And although she seems nervous, Denise had kept quiet about the situation at hand. It was enough to frustrate any investigator. Denise reverted the conversation back toward the restraining order, and although that raised questions again, it seemed that Denise was able to maintain control over the conversation for the remainder.
I know the other officer talked to you a lot of different things. Okay, about what's been going on and everything. Okay. I wish I could just get some. Filling some of the pieces of the puzzle. I'd much rather get it from you than from Brian, because when he's arrested, I'm going to talk to him too.
That's fine.
I want to see what he says. Okay. He may say something you don't want to hear. I don't know.
Well, I have no idea.
You're not a clue. done deal, okay? You know, we know what happened. You told us, and again, this is going to be a pretty good video, and I'm sure that they're going to find some of the things that you talked about. So that's solved, so to speak, okay? Eagle's not out here.
And that's not even true. We just But I guess what I'm saying is about the Mike situation that you want to talk about. I don't want to talk about this right now.
Would you talk about it later?
I don't want to talk about this right now. I want to get this settled first.
This is settled.
It's not settled to me, though. I have not gone down. I have not filed the restraining order, and that's what is pressing on me so bad. So I understand that you want to talk about this, but this is what I want to do. This is what has to be done.
Today. You got some time. Almost done. All right. You know why it's so important to talk to you about Mike. This was your husband. He simply vanished. Hopefully, you still have an interest in that.
Well, again, this is my priority right now. I'm not comfortable talking about this right now. I've had an unbelievable day, and it's just all too much right now. I really want to focus on
this. Has it sunk in that you literally saved your own life today?
All I know is I was praying. I don't even know.
You did the right thing coming here. You know that.
I mean, we'll see.
Things that he's seen about, consider what he had in the back of your vehicle. You know, that's a clue right there.
I was just doing the best I could. And
well, you did. You saved your life. I just want that to
stay. Now I just want my daughter and I to continue to be safe. And that's why I'm so worried about this. That's why I can't even focus on that, because all I'm focused on is us and getting through this night when he's going to find out that I told, after I promised him over and over and over that I wouldn't tell anyone. And when he finds out,
well, when somebody does this to you and has a gun involved, they can't really expect you just to ignore that.
But I had set up where I wouldn't tell anyone and I would meet him later in the day.
You were saying everything, point you had to say something again.
Right.
You had to keep saying this, but it's true to save your life.
Right.
And it worked.
And he, I guess, pretty agreed to that and then left. And then I was supposed to meet him and his dad about now, today, to talk about it.
He goes about his opinion to something very, very horrible. Just know his angel, whatever. He did that. Okay.
Yeah.
And he's stuck in your vehicle, and there he was. He didn't knock at your door and say, let's talk about it.
No.
All right?
No.
But he did.
And I guess that's still his kid.
Well, you're going to have to believe that you're alive right now. All right. That's pretty good. He's going to be arrested on some very, very serious charges.
Do you know the procedure as far as, when I file this, if he's already arrested, then he's just arrested, but then he'll get out, tomorrow, right? Or, I don't know how it works.
I have no idea what sort of bond they're going to put on.
So it depends on that.
Yeah.
But when he's out, he can just do whatever, right?
Well, let's hope he doesn't do whatever. Hope it's finally sunk in that he's screwed up. And you can go through the court stuff, and hopefully that will sink in too, that he's up since
I'm just worried about that long period of time where I know, if he gets arrested, there won't be a court date for a long time, and it's that time I'm worried about. That's where he's out, knows that I told.
He can't be that stupid to think that you're not going to tell.
I'm just worried about that time in between. I'm worried about me and my daughter and where we're going to live and how we're going to be safe. I don't even have a dog.
Yeah. Well, what we have seen, we've seen the side of Mike, not Mike, but Ryan, that we knew was there, and it surfaced again. Okay? Because, again, we've kind of tracked his history. And we also know, Mike vanishes. So.
Well, I myself have never seen anything like what I saw this morning. Never.
Well, what about
that was on a whole, this took it to a whole nother, that was nothing compared to this. But when he left, when he got out of the truck, he was crying, I'm so sorry, and said, like, back, calm and not that person anymore. That's how I left him, and that's how I wanted to stay, and then me coming here and filing this and him finding out.
That's the way he wanted to stay. You really think he would never explode like this again?
I would have never thought he would have done this, so I don't have to, because I haven't. I mean, obviously, he's capable of what he did today, because he did it.
Do you think he's responsible for Mike's disappearance?
I do not, and I never have. I would have never married him if I thought that. I would have never wanted so bad to have children with him. I would have, I mean, in my mind and in my heart, no. David is my brother-in-law, and he was just been here talking to me about trying to get me to understand that, you know, that my life was in danger today.
Absolutely.
And then having me to look back on that whole situation now from a different point of view. And I'm definitely going to do that. But do I believe right here in this moment that he had anything to do with that? Absolutely not. Does that mean that I'm not going to process this and then go back? Of course I am. But I've got to process this first. And I know you understand that.
Well, process this, but please, when you find time to go back, you need to process a whole lot about whatever happened. Because in studying this whole situation, we knew that one day there would be a blow up. We predicted that.
There was.
Oh, I don't think it's finished yet as far as people talking about different things.
No, but I just mean between me and him this morning was a blow up.
Yeah, it was. I'm sorry, I'm a broken record, but I hope it is sinking in how bad it could have been.
I think it'll take some time, but I'm realizing the depths of what could have happened to
you. You know, you don't care that stuff, never gonna, you know, sleep with it or whatever. Or you say something, you thought maybe the sheets were used, or he was going to use for sleep or whatever. No, I don't think so. You had plastic and whatever the other two was.
And again, I hope that backpack's still there. I hope they can, whoever, the police can pull it out and see exactly, you know what I'm saying? Because it was a turn, you know, a couple glimpses and that was it. But I'm pretty sure I'm right. But I'd like to know myself. Did I see this right? Did I, you know what I mean? Like, what was in there? I would like to know.
We'll find out.
Just to confirm.
When they find him, I'm sure that they'll eventually get to whatever that was.
I hope so.
That's down the road.
Something was amiss, and Denise was hiding behind Brian's malfeasance. The only way out was with deceit, but it seemed that law enforcement had an idea of what pieces were missing from the puzzle. They would soon learn that they were right, in a way. In anyone's eyes, the way that events unfolded regarding Mike Williams' drowning are quite fishy. The messy details, such as the time it took for his body to show up, are disconcerting enough. When added with the facts surrounding Mike's life, a disturbing amount of sense is made from the newly connected dots. The overlapping insurance policies, the tryst between Mike's wife and the Winchesters, and the timing of his disappearance all pointed to something dark and deep lurking within the mystery of Mike's death. At the core of it all, though, was the danger that comes with people who choose vice over virtue. There was more to it, for sure, but one thing was clear from the discoveries made so far. Vice had a grip on someone close to Mike, and only after a long, hard look would the truth of his death be made completely evident. Sin was running rampant, and someone made Mike pay the price. In the heated aftermath of the surprise interrogation, Denise was surprised to find Brian being arrested for his kidnapping of her and her daughter. When this happened, Denise closed herself off to the police, whose remaining questions would continue to be unanswered. The estranged couple then learned that his recent acts of rashness had earned him up to a life sentence in prison, and Denise began to worry how long Brian's silence would last. Their secrets were about to be exposed. Denise then called her old friend, Kathy Winchester Thomas, to relay a message through Brian's dad that she wasn't going to talk to the police. Brian, after receiving this message, maintained silence for a period before eventually agreeing to a proffer with the DA. Because his proposed sentence for the kidnapping was up to a life in prison, Brian realized that he had nothing left to lose, so he planned to work out a deal with the DA in hopes that bringing closure to a years-old case would give him some sort of respite. Brian, who pled guilty to aggravated kidnapping, and in the wake of his deal, he was only sentenced to 20 years in prison, with 15 years of probation. In compared to a life sentence, Brian had gotten off easy. Denise, on the other hand, had no idea about the deal being made. She made her case against Brian for the kidnapping, still not bringing up anything about her first husband. Soon afterward, she would realize how much of that refusal had hurt her, and she'd be arrested for the first-degree murder and other criminal charges against Mike Williams. She was to face justice, after all. There was a live televised trial that espoused the notion of exposing Denise's deeds. Brian Winchester, who had worked out an immunity agreement, took the stand as witness to Denise's part in the murder of Mike Williams, and Denise could only watch as the story unfolded. An affair between Denise and Brian, filled with increasingly lewd behavior, in addition to their threesomes with Brian's then-wife, Kathy, shocked and awed the courtroom. Mike's body, thanks to Brian's cooperation, was finally recovered, and Brian shared video proof of his dalliances with Denise behind Mike's back. It was clear from the provisions that Brian's best interest was to be truthful from the start of the trial, so he began to share what the circumstantial evidence had already pointed out. Brian and Denise began their relationship at a concert 3 years before Mike's murder. Their relationship, however, diluted its beginnings, would see an end if they didn't find a way to split up Denise and Mike. And Mike, of course, was deeply religious, so divorce was out of the question. In addition, Denise wanted the support of the community, something that a homewrecker and a cheating wife would not earn. A widow, however, would earn not only the support, but the money attached to Mike's life insurance policies. Brian went hunting with Mike. When Mike fell and had a near-death experience on the trip, it inspired Brian to take the relationship of his and Denise into his own hands. Planning an elaborate hunting trip for the two men, Brian discussed with Denise the lies she would need to tell the police in order to keep the story bulletproof. Brian took Mike to a secret hunting spot at Lake Seminole, where his truck would later be found, and he attempted to drown Mike. Mike, resourceful as he was, managed to slide out of his waders and attempt to swim ashore, thrashing and yelling for help from his best friend, Brian. Brian, disappointed in the long and arduous process this was turning out to be, drew his boat close enough soon to shoot Mike in the head, point blank. The following trial was a regular bloodbath, filled with shot after shot against the glassy-eyed Denise, who likely knew that she was done in. In discussion of the affair, of the stigma of divorce, and of Denise's selfish desire to keep her daughter to herself, her motive for the crimes in question became all too clear. In addition, her profit of over $2 million gave pause to the deliberation, who were asked to consider who Mike's killer really was. The defense attorney pointed to Brian's acts on the lake, his insistent control of the relationship between him and Denise, and the money that was to be had in the event of Mike's death. Each side painting a portrait of their own killer, the trial eventually swayed to one side. After a 4-day trial, it was clear that Denise Winchester was going to be found guilty on all accounts. And although one of his killers found immunity, Mike was receiving a bit of justice after all of these years. It wasn't ideal, of course, but the efforts of his mother Cheryl had finally made good on their goal. It's likely that it wasn't the danger of Brian's relationship with Denise that had caused her to reach out to police. Perhaps after approximately 17 years of silence, her conscience had begun to push her to the act. Her pact of silence with Brian didn't last, but it was Denise who had given the opportunity to break it first. If she had, the trial that went down would have likely gone a whole different way. Two killers, two sinners, two mad people with lust and greed in their hearts had agreed to take a life, and if they hadn't, they would have gleefully awaited the eventual deaths of their partners by happenstance. If that's what devotion looks like, there are some scary people out there looking to fill the role. In the end, though, the truth did come out. Even if only one murderer got to serve time for the delivery that led to Mike's untimely death, that's still one more than had been caught in 17 years following his murder. Sometimes in the face of dark deeds, neither good nor evil wins the whole battle. In fact, sometimes there's only a half victory, where one might expect full justice. Perhaps now, though, the sins that came to light can be remembered as a warning. Perhaps, if at all possible, Cheryl Williams and other mothers like her can rest knowing that the truth has finally been found. It's not often that it happens, but Cheryl and her family can tell you with confidence that it's not always strangers that sin against you the most. Sometimes, whether it's our best friend or a spouse, the closest confidant we have may be, in fact, another devil we know. Thank you so much for listening to Devil We Know. We'll be back next Friday with another episode. You can go on Twitter or Facebook at Devil We Know Podcast, comment on what you thought of the episode, or you can go to iTunes. It would be awesome if you left a 5-star rating and left a nice short comment. That would really help out the podcast and help us climb the charts. Please stay tuned and listen to these two promos of two podcasts that I recently found.
I'm Vicky.
I'm Janelle.
And we like talking about murder.
Like a lot.
Like John Wayne Gacy.
Nanny Doss.
Ted Bundy.
Did someone say Jeffrey Dahmer?
And maybe a little Jim Jones.
Oh, definitely Jim Jones.
If you like any of this, join us every other week on the Bad Taste Crime Cast. You can find us on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever podcasts are hosted.
Yeah, guys.
We'll see you there.
Investigators, this is a lesser-known double murder case out of San Diego, California, where the convicted killer would attack young high school age girls, including Chelsea King and Amber Dubois. After his arrest, Amber's mother was able to get into the holding area and face her daughter's killer.